Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, June 4th, 2019. Sudan's military junta announces the suspension of all agreements with the Freedom and Change Coalition.
The Freedom and Change Coalition, they have rejected the move announced by the military junta. And they called on the mass public and their supporters across the country to continue protesting against the decision of the military junta.
And the UN Security Council meets to discuss the crisis in Sudan.
The British and Germany have asked for a meeting today, and it's going to take place late in the afternoon Tuesday in New York. They're going to be briefed by Nicholas Haysom, who is the Secretary General's relatively newly appointed envoy to be his sort of his point person on Sudan.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The military junta in Sudan has deployed troops around government buildings and major roads leading to Khartoum. The head of the junta, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhani, announced Tuesday that the Transitional Military Council has cancelled talks with the activists who are demanding for a civilian-led government in Sudan. Our reporter Mangu Ugali is in Sudan and has been monitoring developments in the twin cities of Khartoum and Omdurman. He says the announcement by the junta has angered activists and paralyzed life in the capital.
The Sudanese military junta announced the suspension of all forms of negotiations with the Freedom and Change Coalition, and they call for an early national election in Sudan within the next 9 months. According to the head of the military junta, Abdel Fattah Burhan, he says this will be supervised and monitored by the regional and international observatory bodies. He said this during a statement broadcast on the Sudan National TV early today, Tuesday morning. Burhan also said there will be a steering interim body which will be formed soon to run the country for the next 9 months before the election is held.
What is the reaction of the ordinary people on the streets, especially the protesters who have been sitting in front of the military headquarters? What is their reaction to this statement?
The reaction has been, it's obvious that they have rejected this move. The Freedom and Change Coalition, they have rejected the move announced by the military junta. And they called on the mass public and their supporters across the country to continue protesting against the decision of the military junta. So on the street, you could see a lot of gathering. Young people especially are gathering on the junctions and on the main streets. Life has been paralyzed and people are just seated home. People are gathering on the main street, maybe just to try to monitor the situation, how it goes.
And today is Eid al-Fitr, and you know, this is a big day in Islamic countries like Sudan. How are people celebrating this Eid?
I woke up this morning and I went to a neighbor of mine. I was wishing him a happy Eid, and then he told me, no, they are not celebrating Eid today. I said, why? Because they have not been announced by the authorities in Sudan. But what he was telling me this morning, that there are some parts in Sudan are celebrating Eid today. But majority have decided to celebrate Eid tomorrow. Those who are celebrating today, they actually they are following the Saudi Arabia calendar.
Activists are saying that there are militias on the streets shooting at them. I mean, what kind of troops are deployed on the streets of Khartoum, according to what you have seen?
Since yesterday, mainly on the street, you see rapid support forces.
Who were formerly the Janjaweed, right?
Previously known as Janjaweed, led by the current deputy military junta head, Mohamed Himeti. He's known as Himeti. This is what the Sudanese in general, the population, the civilians are calling them militia because they are not, according to them, they are not military, they are not trained. They were just given guns and for certain purposes. But at the end of the day, They even came to the capital now in charge of some, you know, basic installation and basic the government.
And what do they tell people when, for instance, I've seen videos where they stop cars and ask passengers to disembark. What do they tell people?
So they seems to be asking them questions like, if civilians were allowed alone to overthrow the previous regime, would that be successful? So they are saying they will not leave the power. They are not in a position of leaving the power to the civilians alone. They also need to be part of the government. And to add on that, on the latest information also, the death toll on the situation of yesterday, according to the Sudanese Doctors Committee, lately this morning, that the death toll has increased to 35. But still, voices within the Declaration of Freedom and Change Forces are still saying this is not the real figure of the death toll. Some of them believe still that bodies were thrown into the River Nile, but this is yet to be confirmed as time goes.
That's our reporter, Mungu Ugali, in Khartoum. He was talking to me earlier today. Sudanese nationals living in Juba are condemning yesterday's violence that left at least 35 people dead in Khartoum. The Sudanese nationals say the military council must hand over power to civilians. Lasuba Memo has this report for VOA from Juba.
Sudanese nationals here in Juba called the loss of innocent lives in Khartoum painful. 42-year-old Sudanese businessman Garamadin Adam Abdelkarim says while the end of the holy month of Ramadan should be a time of happiness, Sudanese residing in the South Sudanese capital were extremely saddened to hear that security forces opened fire on unarmed civilians on the eve of the Eid al-Fitr.
It is true this is our feast, but what is so surprising is the killing of our people who were protesting, and we have reached a very bad stage. This is what pains us, and today, though we are celebrating, we are not happy. And as you can see, we are at home. Our message to the military council, let it hand over power to civilians, because over the period of 30 years, we have been under a military regime which has done bad things to us. That is why some had to flee.
Yakub Abdallah says he fled insecurity in Darfur in 2013. Speaking in Arabic, he says Sudanese security forces in Khartoum must stop killing innocent civilians.
Our message is clear. They either hand over power to the civilians, or we continue with the protest, or take any other measures. The killings of yesterday and the day before is new to those in Khartoum. But for those of us from Darfur and Nuba Mountains, too many were killed and this new incident will not benefit one of them.
Another Sudanese national living in Juba, Al-Hafiz Abubakar Mahmoud, says despite the violence, he hopes Sudan's leaders will resolve the stalemate. Mahmoud, a trader who is originally from Darfur, is advising South Sudanese to avoid conflict and focus on developing their country.
To South Sudanese, you unite your ranks, love yourselves, and do not fight with each other, because fighting forced us out of Sudan to South Sudan. In South Sudan, there has been war for some time now, but we hope there will be peace in South Sudan and Sudan.
Sudanese nationals here say they hope the situation in their country will return to normal soon so they can return home. The Sudanese military junta has come under mounting condemnation for the killing of unarmed pro-democracy protesters. The Sudanese Alliance for Freedom and Change says it is cutting all contact with the Transitional Military Council and is calling for civil disobedience and a general strike, including the civil aviation sector. For VOA, I am Lasuba Memo in Juba.
Still on Sudan, U.S. reaction to the developments in Khartoum has been swift and direct, with top officials condemning the attacks on civilians. My colleague Ayen Dengbior has more from Washington.
In a 5-thread tweet, Tibor Nice, the U.S. State Department's Assistant Secretary for the Bureau of African Affairs, wrote that the attacks against peaceful protesters are, quote, counter to the military junta claims that they are interested in negotiating a transition to civilian rule, and underscored the need for an immediate agreement with the FFC to transition to a civilian-led interim government, end quote. He added that a rushed election or transition to a technocratic government that does not include the main opposition coalition will not suffice. He also added that the path to stability, recovery, and partnership with the U.S. is through a civilian-led government. John Bolton, the White House National Security Advisor, echoed those remarks, saying on Twitter that the Transitional Military Council must speed transition to a civilian-led government, as demanded by the Sudanese. U.S. Representative Karen Bass, the highest-ranking Democrat on the House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on Africa, condemned the attacks against protesters. In a written statement yesterday, Congresswoman Bass said she is disappointed that security forces would fire live ammunition, causing multiple fatalities. She further wrote that shutting down media networks in the capital is a, quote, clear infringement on press freedoms.
The United Nations Security Council is holding a closed-door meeting in New York to discuss the latest developments in Sudan. VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashar explains how council members might be approaching the developments taking place in Khartoum.
In the beginning, they've sort of been hands-off. But now that it's escalated, the British and Germany have asked for a meeting today, and it's going to take place late in the afternoon Tuesday in New York. It's going to be a closed-door meeting. They're going to be briefed by Nicholas Haysom, who is the Secretary General's relatively newly appointed envoy to be his point person on Sudan since President Bashir stepped down.
Does the closed-door meeting later today have any significance? I mean, in other words, is it common for the Security Council to hold a closed-door meeting of this nature?
Yes, it's very common for the Council to discuss things privately, and sometimes they discuss them behind closed doors informally, sometimes more formally. In this situation, I think in part, probably some council members didn't want a public meeting because they felt it's not particularly an agenda item. So that could be one of the reasons it's behind closed doors. But also, you know, they just want to get a sense of the situation. I mean, they're just trying to gather information right now. And one of the diplomats said to me on Monday that they're concerned about the situation, that stability in Sudan is important for the whole region, and that they very much want to see a Sudan-driven resolution to the situation. And, you know, we heard that also from the South African ambassador who sits on the council. He says he hopes that the protesters and the government working with the AU Peace and Security Council can solve this. And as you know, at the end of June, the AU has imposed deadlines on Sudan to get a civilian transitional government in place. So what's going to happen now? So I think the council wants to be briefed. They want to hear where things are headed and hopefully prevent an escalation in the situation.
So I'm just wondering, because I know that the Security Council has been deep on Darfur, and we've seen reports about Darfur, and I'm just wondering, you know, what role does the council have in the political matters in Khartoum, in the capital?
Well, they don't, because that's what a lot of countries are saying, like a Russia and a China and a South Africa. Those kind of countries are saying this is an internal matter. It's not a threat to international peace and security, which is what the Security Council's mandate is. And a lot of countries, like a Russia, like a China, don't like to see the council interfering in these sorts of situations because they don't want people interfering in their personal situations. So they like to keep the council out of these sort of things. But in this case, two Western countries have asked for the briefing. And basically right now it's just an information gathering exercise. But look, how bad would it look if the council didn't take it up and then it escalated? They would be blamed later for not taking it up.
That's VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashar speaking with my colleague Deng Bior from New York this past hour. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at the reaction of South Sudanese to family planning. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
Who motivates you?
My mom, because she tells me what is right and what is wrong, what I'm supposed to follow. That's why she's my motivator.
I would say my dad, because I see him as my role model. He's very hardworking, and he makes sure that when he sets his mind to do something, he does it.
Well, for me, no one motivates me, but I motivate myself. Well, I can't say anyone, but I can say myself, because for me, I'm really talented. I have so many things I can do.
Well, many things motivates me in my life, my business, my place of work. It gives me courage, yeah. What motivates me most is my family, like my children, how I'm going to bring them up, their education. Those are the areas I look much more for.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. It's time for our Tuesday health segment. And today, we are talking about family planning in South Sudan. Despite cultural beliefs and societal norms that favor bearing multiple children, some women in South Sudan say they are using various forms of birth control so they can take care of all their children. Winnie Chirino has details for VOA from Juba.
Doreen Aringo, a mother of four, says she started using birth control after having two children who are aged 2 years apart. Aringo says she and her husband decided to use birth control because the couple did not have enough resources to take care of a large family. Aringo says she and her husband are both government employees with irregular salaries, making it difficult for the couple to provide for their children.
The salary wasn't enough to support myself and the two children I had before. So I started thinking deeply by going to get a family planning, at least if I can stay 3 years, because these 2 years was not enough for me that my child was breastfeeding.
Aringo says she and her husband agreed to wait 3.5 years before having more children so they would be prepared to provide a larger family and allow her body to recover. Grace Pony, a mother of two, says she gave birth to her firstborn when she was still in primary school. Pony says she learned about family planning at the hospital when she took her first child for treatment and medical checkups. Speaking in Arabic, Pony says she and her husband agreed to use family planning so she could finish primary school.
That is what I did with my first child. Then I removed it and I gave birth to my second child. It helped me so much because by the time I gave birth to the other child, my body was fine and I had thought of going back to school until I finished primary 8. And now I am in secondary school, and the other two children, I will give birth to them when I have done something good to help my children.
Juba resident Joseph Amanya, who has three children, says many South Sudanese parents stick to traditional beliefs that encourage couples to produce many children, regardless of whether they can provide adequate support for their families. He says he and his wife agreed to space their children in order to give all of them the attention they deserve.
The most important thing why we do family planning is, first of all, is that you are able to take the responsibility of the children that you're going to produce. You don't need to produce children that you will be irresponsible. You won't be able to take care of them. They won't be able to go to school. You won't be able to attend to their medical needs, school, and other basic needs that children need as members of the family.
Lucia Valentina, a midwife and family planning expert at Juba Teaching Hospital, says health workers encourage women to bring their husbands to family planning counseling sessions, but there are always women who come alone. Valentina says last week, an unidentified man whose wife began bleeding after taking birth control pills came to the clinic to threaten her.
The man came to us and then he said, "You people, who told you to give family planning to my wife without a consent?" And then say that, "Hey, you don't know that family planning is against our culture. If my wife doesn't produce now, what will you do? I will sue you to the court."
Valentina says the man's wife lied about discussing child spacing with her husband, telling health workers at the clinic that he was fine with it. Juba Teaching Hospital offers free family planning services depending on what a couple prefers to use. Valentina says the Depo-Provera injection is effective for 3 months. The combined oral contraceptive tablets are effective for 1 month. The implant, which is inserted under the skin, is effective for 3 years, and the intrauterine device is effective for 10 years. She notes that there can be some side effects associated with birth control.
Heavy bleeding, menstruation period, sometimes it will come very heavy.
Valentina says many South Sudanese still believe birth control methods make women barren. She says couples need to be educated about family planning methods so they understand their benefits. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Yei, as Muslims around the world celebrate Eid al-Fitr at the end of the holy month of Ramadan. Some Muslim leaders in South Sudan are appealing to the country's leaders to restore peace. Daniel Friday Martin has more for VOA from Yei Town.
Thousands of Muslims gathered at Yei's Freedom Square to pray after fasting for 30 days. Among them was Ali Morgar, Secretary General of the Islamic Council in Yei River State. Morgar says although Muslim leaders are working to unite and reconcile communities, the sole responsibility of restoring lasting peace and stability across the country lies with the government.
Always to pray for peace, and we preach for unity, love, and togetherness within the population. To the leaders of our state and South Sudan in general, we need peace. We need services. Once there is peace, I know our people will realize development to create comfort in our people. We as Muslim leaders always advocate for our people to be provided the needed services. And so our leaders should consider us part and parcel of this nation.
Sheikh Razab Sabit of the Yei Central Mosque is urging government and opposition leaders at the local, state and national level to put aside their differences for the sake of the South Sudanese people who have suffered greatly during the conflict.
If our leaders are united, I think peace will come automatically. But if they are divided, I don't think so. Why do you say what you don't do? So our leaders, they have to tell us the truth. They have to act what they have said, because we'll come and account everybody according to the words you are saying.
Sheikh Sabit is calling on the country's citizens to unite in order to move the country towards economic development. Speaking in Arabic, Yei Town Muslim resident Amina Noor urged the town's Christian residents to join the Muslim community in promoting peace and unity in South Sudan.
What we want is peace and harmony with our children in South Sudan. We don't want war, and if we meet on the road with our brothers and sisters from the Christian community, we need to greet ourselves and show love and unity among ourselves as one people in South Sudan.
Speaking in Arabic, 27-year-old Mohammed Ali, another resident in Yei's Dar el Salaam suburb, says all South Sudanese, including those in the diaspora, should preach unity and peaceful coexistence.
Al-Islam bimana wal-Islam wal-peace.
Islamic means peace. I want to call on our brothers who are staying either inside South Sudan or overseas. We want peace and unity, and we need to support peace, not war.
In his Eid al-Fitr message to Muslims, Yei River State Governor Emmanuel Adil urged residents to forgive one another and join state leaders in their commitment to restoring peace.
I want to urge all of us as South Sudanese to honor the revitalizer agreement. Forgive one another irrespective of the great enmity and hatred that has swallowed our hearts and minds, and let's instill love, hope, and confidence, a renewal of our identity as South Sudanese. This Eid al-Adha al-Mubarak 2019 should be committed to bind unity between Muslims and Christians. Should also bind unity between tribes, unity among family members. Abraham's covenant with Allah should be translated into the permanent covenant of peace in South Sudan, and particularly in Yei, as we enter into the phase of the implementation of the agreement.
Adil praised the warm relations that he says already exist between the Christian and the Muslim communities of Yei River State. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin, reporting from Yei Town.
South Sudanese employees at the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization went on strike on Monday. The employees say the UN failed to pay their allowances, including full medical insurance, compensation for overtime worked, and other benefits the UN agencies pay their staff in South Sudan. Wake, Simon Wudu has more for VOA from Juba.
Gama Joseph Joshua, chairperson of FAO's National Staff Association, says the employees asked their employer to address their grievances back in 2013. Joshua says last month the employees tried to raise their issue again and submitted a list of demands to the organization's management. He says since then employees have been waiting for response.
Basically, we are provoked by non-payment of the danger pay, and then we have a number of other two issues that provoke this walkout today. If you go back on the 15th or so, we walked out from the office and presented these three items that are supposed to be solved by the management.
Joshua says the danger pay is an allowance paid to the staff regardless of their contract type because South Sudan is considered a conflict zone. He says the employees also want the organization to revise its medical insurance cover. He says now FAO's insurance policy only covers the employee and excludes his or her family. He says this is contrary to FAO's medical insurance policy for international staff. Joshua also says national employees want FAO to pay for overtime. He says some of the staffs, including drivers, sometimes work beyond the mandatory 8-hour schedule. He says work is sometimes over 8 hours, but employees get paid no overtime. Joshua says because of the economic crisis in the country, South Sudanese employees believe that paying the benefits they are demanding will improve their lives and the lives of their dependents.
And you see the lives of people who are getting are even better than the lives of people who are not getting, the staff who are not getting. If you approach and ask the other people of Rwanda agents like WP, you say, how are you feeling because they're getting this? They said, this one cut for them for even renting their houses. This one cut for them to do other developmental things. You can see the difference of $500 on top of your salaries. Mm-hmm. What does it mean? That's a very big jump.
David Mbale is a senior driver who has worked for the FAO in South Sudan since 2006. He says for the last 13 years, he has continued to receive the same salary. He says despite his attempts to get a pay rise, FAO has ignored his requests. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
That report by Wudu in Juba brings us to the end of our show for this Tuesday. We now take you a little bit down to Yambio with a traditional Zande song. This one is called Ashawo. Been listening to traditional Zande group with the song Ashawo. This one goes out to my best friend Richard Rwati in Juba. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being here. We hope you can join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.